welcome to Breakpoints, the Society of Infectious Diseases Pharmacists podcast. My name is Julianne Justo, and I'm a clinical pharmacist lead in infectious diseases at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Today, it's time to lock, stock, and sterilize. We are talking all things antimicrobial locks. How many times have you thought of or recommended antimicrobial lock therapy for your patient, only to quietly walk it back when realizing the logistical challenges involved? I have absolutely been there as a pharmacist. Our best chance to utilize antimicrobial strategies successfully is really to implement a plan, a policy, an order set, recipe book, or pretty much all of the above, well ahead of time. If this has been on your to-do list for your own practice site, well, this episode is for you. And even if it's not on your to-do list, we will review the current evidence on prevention and treatment of catheter-related bloodstream infections, or CRBSIs, and outline real-world implementation strategies that will allow you to decide if this is something worth pursuing. Funding for this episode was provided by a grant from CoreMedics. We appreciate their support of SIDP's ongoing mission. To explore this topic, we're bringing out a true Swiss Army knife of a panel. We needed a bunch of varied expertise to talk about this topic. First, I'd like to welcome Dr. Louise Marie Oleksik, better known as Lou, who is a clinical pharmacist in infectious diseases and antimicrobial stewardship at UPMC Shadyside in Pittsburgh, and an avid lover of water and winter sports. As a new Englander myself, I'm getting used to the winter sports, so I got a lot to talk about with Lou after we record this pod. Lou and I are kindred spirits with a love of practical pharmacy solutions, and she was also a pivotal mentor to our very own SIDP podcast committee chair and co-host extraordinaire, Jeanette Bouchard. Lou helped stoke a love of ID clinical pharmacy in Jeanette that helped her find her way to my prior institution in South Carolina, where she spent many years with me for IDPGY2 and fellowship training. Jeanette and I became great friends as a result, and I really, really owe Lou a huge thanks for her part in that. So thank you, Lou, and welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. And hi, Jeanette, if you're listening.
And next, we have Dr. Nasia Safdar, professor of infectious diseases at UW-Madison and an avid gardener. I've got lots of questions for her on what she likes to put in her garden. But anyway, Dr. Safdar is also a panel member on the upcoming IDSA clinical practice guidelines for the diagnosis and management of intravascular catheter-related infections. I recall when the last version of this guideline was published. Guys, it was my PGY 1 year back in 2009. So I'm dating myself and I'm dating these guidelines. Dr. Safdar gave us a sneak peek of some of the pending updates during ID Week 2023 in Boston this past October. I really encourage you to check it out on the ID Week website if you haven't already. It generated a great discussion among the audience and discussed many topics beyond what we will focus on today on antimicrobial locks. We are so excited to hear her perspectives on antimicrobial lock therapy in particular. Nasia, thank you for joining us.
Very excited to be here, and thank you for having me.
And our third panelist for today's episode is someone I've long admired in the social media and podcast space, Dr. Joel Toff. Dr. Toff is an assistant clinical professor of medicine at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine. We're excited to hear Dr. Toff's real-world perspectives on prevention of catheter-related bloodstream infection as a nephrologist. And I'm secretly hoping that he'll bring us on the next Neph Madness pod crawl. What is Neph Madness pod crawl, you ask? It brings together a group of different podcasts who agree to publish episodes on a similar theme, in this case, nephrology, around a similar time, in this case, March Madness, in order to bring listeners of a community together and introduce folks to new podcasts. As an audiophile and avid podcast listener myself, I'm in awe of this concept of a pod crawl. It is so fun and pretty genius. So hats off to you, Joel. You can also listen to Joel's podcast, Freely Filtered, excellent name, by the way, for great Journal Club content in the nephrology space. Welcome, Joel.
I am super honored to be here. I'm pretty excited to be on the other end of the microphone. I'm usually the host, and I'll tell you, it's a lot easier to be the guest, and I'm pretty happy and comfortable. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, we are so excited. Don't think it's easy yet. We haven't finished the episode. but with that, let's go ahead and jump right in. I want to get started with the basics. What is antimicrobial lock therapy? How is it theorized to benefit in the prevention or treatment of catheter-related bloodstream infections?
I can go ahead and take that one, Julie. So antimicrobial lock therapy, or sometimes I abbreviate to ALT, consists of filling the lumen of a catheter with a highly concentrated antimicrobial solution, and then allowing it to dwell or lock for a period of time while the catheter is not in use. The goal of this technique is to essentially eradicate or prevent luminal colonization by a microorganism. So antimicrobial lock therapy can be used in one of two ways. The first, which is the one that I commonly see used in my institution, is as an adjunct to systemic antimicrobial therapy for the treatment of a catheter-related bloodstream infection with the aim to salvage the central venous catheter. Another way that these get utilized, and we see these a little bit more in our home parenteral nutrition patient population on the outpatient side, is to prevent catheter-related bloodstream infections in patients who have ongoing long-term needs for central venous catheters and have limited venous access and have had multiple catheter-related bloodstream infections despite maximal efforts at preventing subsequent infections. So inherent to both of these indications, patient populations that can benefit from antimicrobial lock therapy include oncology, hemodialysis, and those receiving chronic parenteral nutrition.
Great. Thank you, Lou, for going through that. Anything else you guys want to add, Nasi or Joel?
I think I could just add that, you know, the whole goal of ALT or antibiotic lock therapy or antimicrobial lock therapy is to try and salvage the catheter. And as we see very often in the ICU and other settings, we would try to remove the catheter if at all possible, but there's lots of patient populations that have real challenges with vascular access. And I think as a strategy, this is underutilized in those settings. So I'm so glad we're talking about it today.
Yeah, I would emphasize the underutilized. You know, in nephrology, catheters are kind of our last choice for a chronic dialysis access. And so I think there's little energy being put into trying to make them less toxic. And we're spending a lot of energy just trying to get people to go to a AV fistula or an AV graft, which have a lot of benefits in addition to being more resistant to infection. And I think that it ends up being a blind spot because we haven't been thinking about it. We're directing people away from catheters rather than trying to reduce the morbidity of the catheters themselves.
Yeah, I think that's really, it's important to kind of set the stage and understand the forest for the trees. Very important, take the line out if you don't have an indication for it and try to get, for example, patients on dialysis on more stable, safer access whenever possible. However, I know Lou and I, as pharmacists, we see this. There are patients that, you know, they just have a catheter sometimes for a lot longer than we want. So hopefully we're going to go through a little bit of the logistics.
Well, and I think it's also, as hospital-based pharmacist, and am I correct in assuming that that's your day jobs? Yeah. So you're seeing the group of people that are in the hospital more often because these are problematic accesses and they get more infections. Mm-hmm. And so these end up being an overrepresentation in your mind of the hemodialysis population, though we do have, you know, about 20% of patients are receiving dialysis through a catheter, higher in some populations.
This is absolutely true. And that's why we invited you to the pod, because my perception of catheters is definitely skewed. All right, very good. So now that we've started a little bit with the basics, I want to talk about the characteristics of an ideal lock solution. So what are we looking for in terms of the goal of preventing or treating a catheter-related bloodstream infection?
If you're thinking about what are the characteristics of a lock solution, it's useful to think of the biofilm that's going to be pretty extensive within the lumen of these catheters. And so the whole reason that biofilms are particularly challenging is because it's a living community that is very different from the planktonic bacteria that you might find floating in the bloodstream of patients with centraline bloodstream infections. And so to get to that biofilm, it has to be high concentrations of anti-infectives or antiseptics within that lumen. Lou, do we want to review some of the other characteristics that are important?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And actually, I'd refer our listeners to a few publications that have come out in years past by our podcast host today, Julianne Giusto, along with her former peer, Brandon Bookstaver. But to paraphrase a lot of their work, in addition to making sure you have a spectrum of activity that includes common pathogens that cause catheter-related bloodstream infections, you also, of course, want adequate concentrations. You need stability at both room and body temperature, which actually ends up being something that we as pharmacists care a lot about in selecting locks for various order sets that we have on hand. They have to be potentially compatible with additives. This is particularly important in the hemodialysis patient populations that do require locking with an anticoagulant, typically heparin. But I know sometimes we alternatives, trisodium citrate. You have to have limited systemic absorption to minimize the risk of toxicity. You know, at our site, we really include instructions to withdraw the solution before accessing the catheter, but you do have to make sure that the concentrations that you're utilizing will not pose a risk of toxicity for the patient. You also want to minimize any potential for resistance, and then obviously cost, like it always does, plays a role in antimicrobial locks as well.
Yeah, standard policy is not to flush these catheters through, and that's an important consideration. We used to use heparin at 5,000 units per milliliter. So if you were to flush that through, you'd actually systemically heparinize these patients, and that's not what we try to do right at the beginning of dialysis. And so, you know, of course, the standard practice is not to flush these catheters, but to draw this stuff off. And then I want to emphasize the other consideration is complex recipes that require a lot of mixing by nurses in a dialysis unit are something you want to avoid. And the simplicity is going to be super important here. We like to think of these dialysis units as sophisticated medical places. They provide great care, but they have a lot of patient turnover. They see a lot of patients in a day. The nurses have a huge burden in terms of number of patients. It's usually 10 patients per nurse, sometimes more than that. And so simplicity and trying to avoid potential for error is a really important consideration when you're working in that environment.
In terms of my experience as a pharmacist, a lot of what we end up doing in infectious disease and otherwise is just ensuring patient safety. And anytime you introduce something that's new and unusual or something that folks don't necessarily do on a regular basis, I can imagine if you get to your 10th dialysis patient in the clinic as a nurse, and then they have like this one weird order of an antimicrobial lock that you're not sure where to get, how to instill, what to do, it can really muck things up and kind of honestly increase the risk of medical errors, which is not something any of us want. That's not the intention of the lock to begin with.
I have a question, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
You were talking about getting adequate concentrations of the antibiotic. And I'm used to seeing MICs for these bacteria, but I imagine those are not appropriate for these biofilms where you probably would need much higher concentrations. Is there a different way of measuring that type of target concentration?
I think that comes in handy when people ask, you know, I'm already giving these patients systemic antimicrobial therapy when you're using ALT as adjunct therapy. And they might question, why do you need the lock in addition to that when they're also getting systemic? The rationale that we present is that the systemic anti-infective in those concentrations IV is not getting into the biofilm of the catheter the way that local instillation would. So it's not typically based on the MIC of the antibiotic against the organism, but just that it's several thousand fold higher in that contained space, and it's staying in there with a dwell time, you know, for up to 24 hours sometimes.
Yeah, Joel, I think that's a great question when it comes to, you know, what concentrations are we actually looking at for effectiveness of bactericidal activity within the biofilm. I am not aware of a good laboratory marker like a minimal inhibitory concentration or something similar that would reliably predict effectiveness of sterilizing a biofilm on a catheter. And I mean, there might be some research labs that can do it, but there's certainly not anything in the clinical microbiology lab on a routine basis that would allow us to have some type of surrogate test. Remember, when we're doing the MIC testing that we all get from our bacterial cultures, those are starting with an inoculum of 10 to the 5 colony-forming units per ml. It's a relatively small amount of starting bacteria, and they got plenty of room and nutrients to grow. So they're like rapidly dividing, and all of our cell wall active agents are like wickedly potent in that setting. That's a very different situation than a mature biofilm, which we know from research, you know, it's got that mature glycocalyx layer and its genomics and proteomics of those cells that are just kind of chilling in this home base of the biofilm is very different. And we don't necessarily have good surrogate markers for how much antimicrobial we need, which is why, in theory, we go really concentrated with the antimicrobial that we want dwelling in contact with that biofilm surface. So now that we've talked about some of the ideal lock solution characteristics, I want to spend some time talking about data. What are some of the highlights of the evidence supporting antimicrobial lock therapy for prevention of CRPCs and then for treatment of CRPCs?
I can start talking about the prevention from the antimicrobial and antibiotic perspective. You know, there have been several randomized controlled trials looking at vancomycin as an antibiotic lock therapy for the prevention of centraline-related bloodstream infections. And overall, it shows considerable benefit. The only challenge is, which is not small, is that it's obviously only covering a small proportion of all the organisms that can cause CRBSI. And studies haven't really looked to see when you do get breakthrough infections in people who've been getting these locks for a prolonged period of time as prevention. Those typically will be resistant organisms. They might be gram negatives. They might be fungi like Candida. And so that's the challenge. And so for that reason, I think people don't routinely use these locks for prevention, but try to limit it to a population of patients that have had CRBSI and are therefore at very high risk of getting it again. And patients with intestinal failure, for instance, or those that need TPN is a classic group that's very high risk for prevention. So from the antibiotic standpoint, that's one option. And then, of course, there's new and exciting data on antiseptics, and taurolidine is one where there's been a recent trial that's been published. And Joel, maybe in your role as nephrologist, I bet you're pretty excited about the results.
Yeah. This is the Locket 100 trial. And, you know, when I've looked at some of the data on LOX before, it's a lot of single center trials. It's a lot of small trials. And this one was really done to get FDA clearance for this taurolidine antibiotic LOX, specifically for hemodialysis patients. It was done in 70 dialysis centers, multi-center, double blinded. So this was a randomized trial. Patients were randomized to blinded taurolidine, heparin, or just heparin LOX. And it was time to first infection or failure of the dialysis catheter. And there was an interim step in that study. So after the first 28 infections, they were going to stop, go through the data safety monitoring board, and just make sure there was no signal for danger. And at this time, there was incredible efficacy with six infections with taurolidine heparin versus 22 in the heparin alone. At that point, they were like, we're done. This study is highly significant. The p-value at that point was 0.003. By the time they stopped it, they did collect a few more total infections. So it ended up being 32 catheter-related bloodstream infections with heparin alone versus 9 with the taurolidine heparin combination. Hazard ratio of 0.29, which is kind of blow your mind. The effect size here is so astronomical. Right, I get excited when I get a hazard ratio of 0.85, a 15% reduction. Getting a 71% reduction in something so significant as a bloodstream infection is just huge. It's kind of a stop the presses. And then there was a number of secondary outcomes, looking at safety, catheter life, clotting, all the other things that we look at. No differences whatsoever. So this looked like a clean win. And this is the kind of thing that really, you know, large study in dialysis patients moves the needle on something that's important. I mean, you look at these reviews of bloodstream infection in dialysis patients, and patients that get admitted for this, they have a significant mortality rate in the hospital. So avoiding these infections is avoiding hospitalizations, and that means it's avoiding death. I want to point out, I don't want to overstep the findings of the study. There was no mortality difference in this study, but you start to extrapolate it to a larger population, this could really move the needle and help a lot of dialysis patients.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I think it's really interesting that this taurolidine heparin combination is coming formally to the market. I think a lot of us, especially as pharmacists, we're used to, and we're going to talk a little bit about the recipes that we would make to take injectable IV medications and turn them into IV lock solutions. And it's time consuming and it's complicated. Do you want it with an anticoagulant? Do you not? This particular product is, at least right now, indicated for specifically use in patients on hemodialysis, which streamlines the discussion a little bit as opposed to some of the stuff we use in the hospital, which could be used even outside hemodialysis catheters for other indications like ports and stuff like that. But when looking at this particular product, I agree with you, Joel. I think, you know, 71% risk reduction with this type of high quality study design is particularly useful, not only for this particular product, but for the intention of using an antimicrobial lock for the purposes of prevention across this patient population alone. One quick comment that I do want to make about the trial data. Nasia, you were talking about if we are using antimicrobial locks on a routine basis, it could have implications for the potential subsequent infections that these patients still may receive. I thought it was interesting that among the 9 patients that received the taurolidine heparin that did go on to have a defined event of an adjudicated CRBSE, one of them had a gram-negative organism isolated and 8 had a gram-positive organism isolated. When you compare that to the control arm of heparin alone, 32 patients, there was a little bit more of an even split. 14 had gram-negative organisms isolated, 18 had gram-positive organisms isolated. I'd be curious to know kind of a little bit more detail about that, normally just because I'm in the inpatient setting, and if we're going to deal with the downstream effects of failed LOCK therapy, that would kind of hit my practice site. But I have questions about, you know, taurolidine. It's a unique antimicrobial compound. We're not going to be using it for systemic therapy, so I'm less worried about emergence of resistance. But I am curious to know if this is going to change the epidemiology of subsequent CRBSE infections if patients are using this for prevention on a routine basis. So hopefully more data will come out on that in time as well.
One other issue about that effect size, which is so dramatic. It's dramatic, but it is very believable because there was a Cochrane review that was done before this publication. I think it was like 27 studies that used antibiotic LOCKs. None of them used taurolidine. And they had an effect size, relative risk of 0.38, so 62% reduction. So very similar.
Right, right.
So this is a very believable effect size from what we're
Yeah, and it's plausible that you may not need this particular product, and this could be easily achieved with other products as well. And I keep mentioning, but we are going to talk about the logistics, I promise. I think the last thing that I wanted to say, Joel, I think you mentioned it, but it was such an impressive relative risk reduction that the trial was actually stopped early for efficacy. And that's a pretty high bar for researchers and the sponsor to get to that threshold when they know they're going to the FDA to prove effectiveness and safety.
I see on Twitter a lot of people criticize studies that are stopped early. We do a lot of investigations in my practice, and when we enroll patients in these studies, part of the agreement that we tell patients is that we're doing the study to find an answer. And once we know the answer, we've kind of lost that equipoise, and it really is not fair to the patient to continue to randomize and keep them in the blinded study group once the purpose of the study is complete. I think sometimes people, they want more validity and they want that longer trial or more patients, and you got to understand the importance of the patient's contribution to these studies.
Yeah, absolutely. When, you know, we go into research, we're promising that we're going to follow ethics as we go forward. Definitely something to keep in mind. So I alluded to this a little bit, but I do want to spend some time actually listing out the current products available for use as antimicrobial LOCK therapy. We have this, you know, nice randomized controlled trial that's on this specific agent that is now FDA approved with taurolidine heparin solution. But people have been using antimicrobial LOCK solutions for a very long time. And so if you can, Lou, I'm going to turf this to you as our resident pharmacist on the panel. Can you kind of go through first what we typically have available as antimicrobial LOCK therapy?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. So again, I work on an inpatient side. So the bulk of our antimicrobial LOCKs are used for adjunctive treatment of patients with confirmed catheter-related bloodstream infections. And so we end up offering via various order sets, agents that can cover common gram-positive organisms, and then also common gram-negative organisms that can cause CRBSI. So face up, we offer vancomycin, cefazolin, daptomycin, gentamicin, ceftazidime. We also offer a combination product that includes gent and vancomycin. Each of these is also available with an anticoagulant, which we actually have embedded within a specific hemodialysis order set, which I can go into a little later on.
I will say we also have recipe book on file that includes antimicrobial LOCK recipes for agents that we don't have face up on their order menu, as they should seldom, if ever, be needed. But unfortunately, we have had some historic requests for them, even, let's say, in the setting of a secondary prophylaxis after line removal and placement of a fresh line. And this includes amphotericin B, which admittedly, I can't remember the last time I've seen it used, since I think we can all agree that generally, catheters should always be removed when treating a patient with candidemia.
Nasha, tell me, have you ever recommended salvaging a catheter with a fungemia?
You know, never. That and Staph aureus have the most enormous respect for those two pathogens. Yeah. always remote. It's also important to just remind people, you know, as an infectious diseases clinician, I have to say that we do have to examine the line to make sure there's no tunnel infection or exit site, because then your answer is there. The line has to be removed and ALT is not going to be the answer for you.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. In that Cochrane review, they also looked at non-tunneled catheters, and antibiotic locks had no effect in reducing the infection in non-tunneled catheter where the infection is not going through the lumen, right? It's just going right alongside it.
All right, Lou, what other drug products do you kind of hide from everybody but still have recipes for?
So the only other ones that come to mind are trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole and minocycline, which unfortunately we have been asked about in the setting of infected central lines or ports caused by Sinetrophimonas in our cancer patients. Again, these are hidden locks since no one gets excited about retaining a line infected with Sinetrophimonas, but we have found ourselves needing to do it at least temporarily while we wait to confirm our ability to remove a port, which sometimes can be a balancing act when treating cancer patients.
I will say, you know, these agents, I wouldn't say were readily available at our site easily in years past, right? There would be a patient in whom we wanted to salvage a catheter, and then typically infectious diseases was involved. They would reach out to pharmacy and say, hey, I'm looking to do a line lock for this patient. What can we do? And we really didn't have systems in place to like refer them to like a guideline, or here's like our recipe book, and here's how you enter this medication in the electronic health record. And we've made, you know, great strides to kind of remedy a lot of that and make it a little bit more of a seamless experience for frontline users. In terms of what had been available previously, we did have an order available face up to prescribers, typically in our patients who were receiving TPN, in whom perhaps they had several line infections. We put in like a fresh line and wanted to use antimicrobial lock therapy in the form of ethanol locks to prevent that particular line from getting infected moving forward. And we had been doing that for years, but then a few years ago, a new branded product of dehydrated alcohol, Eblisinol, actually was approved by the FDA. And I think several centers that had been doing ethanol lock therapy pretty much, you know, stopped doing them. I know we initially stopped doing them because they were no longer covered in the outpatient setting. And if we're using it for prevention of catheter-related bloodstream infections, that care is largely going to be received in an outpatient setting. We would sometimes just kind of initiate that before the patient was to be discharged. There's actually a publication that came out in the Journal of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition in 2022 by some providers at UPMC Children's Hospital here in Pittsburgh, alongside some colleagues in Columbus and Cincinnati, that actually looked at the cost-effectiveness of ethanol lock prophylaxis to prevent central line-associated bloodstream infections in children with intestinal failure. And they saw that with the branded product coming to market, it no longer was cost favorable, despite a notable 40% reduction in CLABSIs in that study, to do ethanol lock therapy. And, wow, you know, they were quoting, you know, that before it was costing about $10 a day to provide ethanol lock therapy. And with the branded product, that went up to closer to $1,000. Mm-hmm. And that their break-even point for cost effectiveness was about $78 a day. And so I think people might be excited for the availability of a product like taurolidine, because limitations of using, you know, antibiotic locks for prevention is that typically in prevention, you're trying to cover more than a targeted pathogen. Whereas when you're using them as an adjunctive treatment, you have a specific organism that you're covering. But with our patients who receive chronic TPN, you know, they may have had several CLABSIs in the last year or two, but they're not often caused by the exact same organism. And so it becomes challenging to use an antibiotic lock to cover all of those things for prophylaxis.
I think the other thing about ethanol is that, you know, even though it's true that the bulk of the evidence favors that it reduces CRBSIs, there was a recent large trial in Lancet Infectious Diseases where they found that it was not effective in children with cancer who had been receiving it as well to prevent CRBSI. And so I think that the jury is still out on the true effect of ethanol, and some of it may have to do with the concentration and some of it may have to do with the dwell time, for instance. And then, of course, you can't use ethanol in polyurethane catheters, which also limits its use for many people.
You know, there's some recipes for hemodialysis catheter locks in UpToDate, which is what I have been leaning on when I've wanted to use these And they have four different recipes, a vinc ceftazolock, a vinc alone lock, a ceftazolone lock, and then a cefazolin lock if you have a MSSA infection. And these, they're pretty simple, they're pretty straightforward, and it's kind of a reliable resource that people usually trust, and it's what I've used.
I like that, keeping it clean and simple. I think it can be daunting for folks at their local institution to try to come up with a recipe list of what they want to offer. To Lou's point, it doesn't feel good when it's a scramble for an individual patient that has an urgent need to develop a recipe within the pharmacy and feel like we can safely create an antimicrobial lock, get it through the electronic health record appropriately, teach nursing about it, et cetera. It's better to have these kind of ahead of time. So Joel, I really like your approach of, even if you don't feel like you can have as an exhaustive of a list as what Lou's got at UVMC Shadyside, I encourage clinicians that are listening to this podcast, if you don't have a set list of at least like a vinc and a gent lock, it's probably worth it. And that's a much more manageable list to handle than the pages and pages of tables that I wrote in that review article from a long time ago that had every single antimicrobial under the sun. So again, just a word, as you know, the panel here has kind of talked about, it can be done. Focus on one kind of select gram-negative agent, one select gram-positive agent, and there are options. Real quick, just to make sure that we know, we've talked about a lot of resources over the last few minutes. As always, Breakpoints will put the links to these references within our show notes. So I encourage you guys to take a look there if you're taking notes and hoping to refer to these references in more detail. Okay, so we've alluded to this a little bit. How do we actually do antimicrobial lock therapy in clinical practice?
Okay, so I love this question because we found that it's a lot easier to decide that you want to do an antimicrobial lock than it sometimes is to actually do it.
Preach. So true.
And I will say we find it particularly difficult in patient whose catheter we're trying to salvage is not hemodialysis and not being used for parenteral nutrition, because inevitably that catheter is, at least in the inpatient setting, being utilized several times throughout the day. And so it becomes actually pretty logistically challenging to find an opportune window to lock it for the antimicrobial to dwell for a decent amount of time. So these are the steps that we take when we're trying to actually, you know, operationalize an antimicrobial lock upon request. First is determine the appropriateness. So like I've mentioned previously, most of ours are for inpatient treatment. So we need to make sure that the infecting pathogen is not one that would give us pause. These include notably Staph aureus, Candida, and Pseudomonas. These would almost always require the removal of the central venous catheter. Failure to do that would potentially put the patient at risk for subsequent recurrence, development of an endovascular infection. So you really just want to make sure you remove the line if this is the pathogen that you're dealing with. The next step is to make sure that we select an antimicrobial lock solution that will actually target the pathogen of interest. When it's for treatment, that's a little easier. But if you're looking to implement a line lock for the prevention, then you have to potentially look back to see what the patient has grown in their more recent CLABSIs. We then need to determine the need for an anticoagulant. This becomes less difficult for us because the catheters that we're locking end up being used every day. And it's our local practice to not lock catheters with an anticoagulant if they are utilized daily. And so for us, from a safety standpoint, it's great because most of our antimicrobial locks that we use, we do not actually include an anticoagulant with them. The big exception there is patients who are receiving hemodialysis. They would always be locked with a heparin concentration of 1,000 units per ml if they're able to tolerate heparin. In the outpatient space, which admittedly I don't have as much experience with, you do sometimes have to consider the addition of an anticoagulant, even outside of HD, if your catheter is not going to be utilized as routinely. Then I have to think about the access type. So the location, the number of lumens that you're trying to lock, and then dare I say, the lumen volume.
Oh my God, are we going there? Lou, are you going there?
I am, but just briefly, because I think an entire chapter book could be written with graphs and diagrams about how to determine the lumen volume. And
that two
honestly,
people will read.
This was a barrier to us implementing a formal process for lock therapy for years. And the reason was that
we didn't have a standard process. If we placed the line, then we worked with IR so that in their line placing documentation, they told us the exact volume of the lumens for the catheter that they were inserting. Okay. Because sometimes when they insert it, they can cut the catheter. So sites that just use the manufacturer information, sometimes that can be inaccurate. Although I have, you know, seen some policies elsewhere where that is kind of their go-to reference. They'll just reference the manufacturer information with respect to lumen size. Other places have used this like flushing technique where they'll like flush the lumen and then draw back to see how much blood return they get, and that they determine the lumen volume that way. My nursing colleagues tell me that may not actually be very accurate. And so we've actually sort of given up on finding out the actual lumen volume. And we just use 1 mL for our PICC and apheresis catheters, 2 mL for ports. And then in the hemodialysis space, they really are like a well-oiled machine over there. They always know the exact volume in the HD catheters. And so we dispense a standard volume, but what is charted is the specific volume that is both on the arterial and then the venous side. So that's the only area where we have a slightly different process.
Real quick, what volume do you dispense for the hemodialysis catheters?
So we had started with 3, and then lo and behold, there's sometimes HD catheters that have a lumen volume above 3. So now we dispense 4.
Okay.
And there's 2 lumens. There's an arterial, yes, and a venous lumen.
Yes, which actually for order set purposes makes it wonderfully simple, because you actually have a pre-checked 2 lumens. One's the arterial side, one's the venous side. I actually love locking HD catheters because they're the most, you know, standard catheter to lock, at least in our experience. The last part, which I will say is not the least, is to review the medication profile to determine when you can actually instill the lock to maximize dwell time. And this is the part that, you know, as much as we try to implement systems where we feel like anybody can pick it up and do it, you don't need to call like that one person that's on vacation that knows how to do the line locks on their time off, you can actually. But unfortunately, with this element, you do end up having to have some pharmacist and nursing collaboration to figure out the best time in the day to like retime some medications and identify the best window to actually lock your catheter, particularly, like I said, if you're utilizing for various IV medications or electrolytes or blood products, you know, whatever is going on with the patient's need. And so I'd like to really take this opportunity to give a shout out to all our antimicrobial stewardship pharmacists out there, including my counterpart, Michael Trisler, who ends up covering a lot of our oncology units in the hospital. So inevitably gets looped into a lot of our antimicrobial lock order needs. And then finally, I'll just touch really briefly on dwell time, because this comes up a lot. Typically, antimicrobial locks dwell, you know, I'd say 12 hours a day would be like ideal, sometimes up to 24. Obviously, in hemodialysis, they can dwell 48 up to 72 hours. So stability really needs to be evaluated if you're going to be including that lock for such a prolonged amount of time. In terms of minimum dwell, we use 4 hours. We actually put it on our order, like minimum dwell time is 4 hours. That's not a super evidence-based recommendation. It's based on essentially animal models that suggest that, you know, that is a time at which you can start to see eradication of an organism. But it really still is very much like an expert opinion thing. And I think, you know, if possible, it would be great to have some better research comparing dwell times for locks. I'm sure that's very high on the priority list for for researchers, but it inevitably ends up coming up quite a bit.
Well, that is such an important question, because sometimes it really is hard to find a lumen that is accessible to be locked, especially in the inpatient ICU patient setting. So we have sometimes said, you know, 2 hours is better than no dwell time. But I think you're absolutely right that the longer it can be within the stability constraints that we've talked about, the better it is. And speaking of stability, you know, it's a pretty crude estimate. It's really a visual haze or some other estimate. There's not a great way to know when something ceases to be stable. And so that's the other thing to think about when you're looking at locks that aren't well established. Maybe it's better to stick with the ones that have evidence behind them for stability.
And I'll just add to that real quick, because as we were developing our recipes, it became very apparent, and it's been published, you know, previously, but we really wanted to try to standardize as much as possible. And so for a hemodialysis lox, we wanted to use the standard 1,000 per ml concentration of heparin. But turns out that gentamicin with heparin 1,000 units per ml does precipitate. And so for that particular product, we actually had to go up to 2,500 units per ml, as has been previously published, and as we actually saw locally when we were confirming that our lox were stable. Did you know that, Joel?
I'm still
shaking
getting
his head.
I am still getting PTSD flashbacks from all the stability data that I had to go through in that review from a very long time ago. There's a reason I haven't updated that paper. One important comment that I will make, not all stability data are created equal. And I think, Nasia, this is what you were alluding to. If it's something, if the evidence that's published is something as simple as visual inspection, that's kind of the lowest quality of data. Obviously, if we see haze or visual precipitate, nobody's going to give that to a patient. But there are some data that are out there for more established, better studied antimicrobial lox solutions that do have chemical analysis that can confirm stability at room temperature and at body temperature for up to like 72 hours, which would cover the life of the lox in real practice. So lots of good tips and tricks here. Lou, I very much appreciate, especially that last point that you mentioned, the number of phone calls that I've had to make to interns to say, you guys have continuous fluids running through this line that you're asking me to lock. I think I'm going to stop those, if that's okay with you, and put that under your name. But you know, we have that discussion, and we try to have that discussion on real time in rounds. So Dr. Sufdar is like our ID consultant. I'm sure, you know, you've had these discussions as well, where we decide on IV systemic antibiotic therapy, and then we utter the words lock therapy. And then like the first thing we do is like everybody crowds around the computer to look at the patient's MAR and try, this is again, inpatient bias, looks at the MAR to try to figure out, is this even feasible, right? Because by definition, a lot of these patients that have catheters have access issues to begin with. So really, really important. You cannot give an antimicrobial lock to a line that is being used. I'm talking to you, my students and my trainees in the audience that are learning this for the first time. It's difficult, especially as a pharmacist or physician that's not necessarily administering the lock at the bedside. You just got to remember the practicalities of this. So important information. It seems common sense, but until you do it for the first time and then you run into these issues, you certainly learn the lesson at that point. So that is a ton of things to consider. And honestly, I'm not jazzed about having to go through that huge list of things to consider for every single patient. Is there any way that we can make this process easier to implement in clinical practice? We've talked about a little bit of it, but I want you guys, this is your time to give me your tips. What you got?
Yeah, so I love this question since I get a lot of joy out of helping to implement evidence-based practices, particularly in healthcare settings. And at UPMC, we've been utilizing lock therapy for over a decade, and we really only standardized our process in the last couple of years. So step one, I would say create a guideline that summarizes appropriate criteria for use. And then, you know, you may have some supplemental approval processes depending on your site. I know we require ID or renal involvement depending on the setting in which we're aiming to lock a line. But you want to create orders for commonly utilized antimicrobial locks that are face up in your electronic health record. Like I mentioned previously, we created like a non-hemodialysis order set for PICs and ports, and then a hemodialysis order set that's completely separate. And again, that includes, you know, the products with an anticoagulant. And again, you know, I mentioned this previously, but some gram positive, some gram negative, some combination products potentially. The next step would be to create a how-to document. And this is particularly helpful for nurses because, you know, I'd say we're a site that utilizes lock therapy, not like infrequently, yet I bet it's pretty rare for the same nurse to actually be the one to instill the lock. And so a question that our pharmacy department would often get is you do all the legwork to like get the line lock delivered to the unit. And then inevitably we get questions from nursing because they don't do these a lot. And so we partnered with our IV team or system vascular access team to create a step-by-step how-to document on how to instill an antimicrobial lock. And so that talk about like an easy way to empower pharmacists, right? If they get the question, they just need to refer that user to that specific document. So I think that's a must, honestly, if you're going to implement antimicrobial lock therapy. You also want to ensure you have a recipe on file for your sterile products area to be able to compound each product. And then, you know, if we don't have an order face up in an order set, we actually partner that recipe with a screenshot on how to actually enter the antimicrobial lock in our electronic health system. And then the last step is, and you know, I admittedly, we're still really working through that at UPMC, but is to partner with any home infusion companies that you may be, you know, partnering with or discharging patients to facilitate the transition from inpatient to outpatient lock therapy. Because we have encountered situations where, you know, there were recipe differences or, you know, issues kind of came up in that transitions of care process. So having the partnership with the home infusion companies can really help to ease the transition. And then, you know, of course, if there's any listeners that want advice on how to operationalize locks, feel free to reach out to me directly. But if you're looking for a publication, some folks out of Milwaukee back in 2018 actually published their kind of implementation approach to lock therapy in a pediatric hospital in Milwaukee. So I think that will be linked to the show notes for folks to be able to reference.
Absolutely. And shout out to the first author of that publication, Tracy Zimbles, who's an SIDP board member. We didn't do that on purpose, I promise. But just to show you, we always love all the great work that our SIDP members do, including you, Lou. That is an amazing list of rollouts. I've done antimicrobial lock standardization at prior institutions, but you're giving me things here that I'm like, I'm going to have to email you after this because I need to see that how-to document. And I need to borrow some inspo from that. That was wonderful. I hope you mean that when you ask people to reach out to you, because I have a feeling a lot of our listeners definitely will. And I think that they should. So,
yes.
All right. So pharmacists, we have geeked out on all the how-to stuff, but absolutely, Nasia, Joel, what thoughts do you have on tips for how to get this done efficiently?
Well, from the infectious diseases standpoint, you know, and perhaps that's the case in nephrology too, but there's a lot of variation in provider comfort and the degree to which they will say that antibiotic lock therapy should be done or antimicrobial lock therapy should be done. And so when we have the local guideline, I think it's important to have as upstream a plan as possible so that everybody gets to at least consider it versus just the people that are, you know, really deep into the literature and want to do it and favor it. So everybody should consider it, and then there should be some clear criteria for your own institution for who you would or wouldn't do it. And that may be the same as what's in the literature, like, you know, the line needs to come out because of the pathogen or the integrity or the exit site infection. Or it could be based on logistics. You know, these are the kind of patients where we have challenges following them and we can't do it easily at this time. And those are typically people with lots of challenges in transitions of care, you know, from a SNF to acute care, to a rehab facility, to a step down. Those kinds of settings make it very challenging to have continuity of care. So I think that local guideline is what people will go to. And the more detailed it can be and the more tailored it can be to your local context, the easier people will find it. Most of the time you find fellows and residents going to the national guidelines and they're great for the evidence base, but they aren't going to help you implement it in your setting.
What do your new guidelines say about antibiotic locks?
I think the same as what the evidence would suggest, which is that it's useful as an adjunct for treatment. Depending upon the pathogen, we don't recommend that people try it for Staph aureus or for Candida, but I think the pathogen for which people have had the most success has been coag-negative Staph, where you routinely get good success. And then we just remind people, you know, now that you've decided to keep this catheter in place, we have to pay really good attention to metastatic sites of infection because the source has not been removed, and you should do surveillance blood cultures at the end to make sure that you've accomplished what you've set out to do.
I just did a poll on Twitter and I asked how many people were doing chronic antibiotic locks. And in the first 5 hours, I got 186 votes and only 18% of people in their outpatient dialysis units were using these locks. And that is reflected in my experience. I was speaking with the medical director of one of the large dialysis companies. And they do have a dialysis lock program in place, but it's not one of the dialysis companies that I have access to, and I don't have any patients there. And in general, just, I have not seen this being implemented. I think it's a situation where the cost burden is on the dialysis unit, but the benefit, of course, there's a benefit to the patients to avoid infection, but the cost savings isn't, it doesn't come back to the people that are undertaking the burden, which makes it very difficult to convince people to do that outlay in terms of a time and treasure to execute these types of programs. But I am inherently an optimistic person, and there are some changes that are going on in the way dialysis is being reimbursed in the United States that are going to allow the connection between better care in that outpatient facility, resulting in decreased hospitalizations, going back and reimbursing the people that are doing that outlay. This is part of a value-based care, and we're seeing new values-based programs that are coming in that are really looking at some of these patients that are at tremendous cost of care and what we can do to reduce it. And I think these types of interventions, finding patients that are catheters and for whatever reason, they're not going to be able to get better access, an AV access, a fistula, or a graft. Well, what can we do to reduce the morbidity and mortality associated with it? And so I'm hoping that the better incentives will result in these types of programs being implemented in dialysis units. I'm certainly going to investigate that for our units.
Well, Joel, hopefully you can share the, you know, final production of this podcast with your nephrology colleagues and let us know if they want to partner, because we're always looking for collaborators across the spectrum. And I'm so, so glad that you brought this up. We have alluded quite a few times already that a lot of us focus a fair amount of our practice site in the inpatient setting, which is certainly a popular venue for utilizing antimicrobial lock therapy. But I get so many questions about how to transition the patient and continue antimicrobial lock therapy, either as part of OPAT or in the dialysis clinic. So thank you so much. I was really hoping, Joel, that you would go into some of the issues that we have within our dialysis clinics. This is not my area of expertise at all. However, I do hear from my perspective as a pharmacist about issues with, for example, antimicrobial formularies, just for like the IVs that they're giving, not even the lock solutions themselves. But I get the vibe that margins are thin within our outpatient dialysis centers. You've already told us that we're working with probably max personnel that we can, and we've got really intense workflows. And so I get the sense that there's like little wiggle room to introduce something new. And we got to make sure that it's like clean and simple and safe and effective, et cetera. And Lou, I commend you guys again for the beauty of the order sets that you've created. I've heard about them from a lot of different people independently. We can throw a picture of those in the show notes as well. But I think simplicity is really the key. And that includes in the outpatient settings. I have a couple more questions as it relates to that, but I want to make sure I go back to you, Nasia, because what's your experience with this whole transition of care? Do you have any thoughts on this?
I think the one thing that we've realized is that you cannot underestimate the importance of incentives, particularly reimbursement policies and who is covering the cost of the intervention while not necessarily seeing the benefits from it. And there's a lot of goodwill among providers and ancillary services teams and nursing and, you know, everybody involved in the care of the patient want to do the right thing. But the right thing can be extraordinarily hard to do if the incentives are misaligned. So I'm hopeful that this value-based care that you just described, Joel, will turn the tide on that. I don't think individual people trying to do it will make much headway because the headwinds are just too strong against them at this point.
Yeah. So real quick, we've talked about a couple different things, but does anybody have a plan for how this could be best implemented in a dialysis clinic? Is this feasible? Joel, maybe your friend that actually did this had some tips on how they actually get it done. Does it sound similar to all those steps that Lou outlined for the inpatient setting?
So the only way this will work is if it's, you're not going to have a menu of options. There's going to be one option. It's going to be yes or no that you're going to do it. You'll exclude people that have allergies or other problems. That's how I foresee it being able to be done.
That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Keep it as simple as possible that there's only one solution that you'll use for LOX. We already have to deal with a couple of solutions, right? Because we have patients that have heparin allergies. And so Everybody gets heparin except for those patients. So they're used, there is some possibility for individualization. And this is just another level there. But again, a lot of it is going to be based on cost, right? So a pre-mixed solution is really, it'd be ideal, it'd be simple. But if it's too expensive, it'll get no traction.
All right. So this is Julie back again. And actually, Dr. Toff and I were so interested in trying to figure out what was going on in our dialysis centers in the outpatient setting that we kept this discussion going after we recorded the original podcast. I want to give Joel another second to tell us what he found when he started talking to more of his colleagues around the country.
During the podcast, we talked about how effective these antibiotic locks were. And I really felt, honestly, a bit disappointed that our dialysis units were not doing this, that this seemed like something that could really move the needle, could improve patient health for a vulnerable population, and was a little bit disappointed that this had not been implemented as kind of standard practice. And, you know, as Julie was saying, when I did a little bit more digging, I actually was missing something. Back in 2019, DaVita started a policy where they used chlorhexidine impregnated caps that they would use to seal up the dialysis catheters after every treatment. So it'd be two caps per patient. And these chlorhexidine impregnated caps actually have a little rod that goes down the tunnel of the catheter, and it leaches out the chlorhexidine until you use the dialysis catheter again, you know, 48 to 72 hours later. It functionally works like a lock. And actually, the data is very similar. You get the same kind of really remarkable 0.3, 0.4 relative risk of CRBSI. And in fact, there's an interesting study that I came across, and we'll include it in the show notes, that looked at risk of CRBSI infections. And the hypothesis of the study was that during the pandemic, we became much more conscious of wearing masks and being careful and washing hands and wearing gloves. And the authors thought that this may result in lower CRBSI for people with permacaths. And so they looked at rates of admissions and just use of antibiotics in the dialysis units before and during the pandemic. And they kind of had a couple of years of control years. They looked at 2018, 2019, and then 2020. And what they found is concurrent with the implementation of these chlorhexidine impregnated caps, and before the pandemic, they found a significant reduction in these CRBSI infections. Like, it was an effective therapy in real world use. And then that reduction continued even further during the pandemic. So kind of good real world evidence, or as close as we might be able to get, that this is an effective therapy in a kind of a pragmatic or natural experiment.
It makes a lot of sense with the devastating impacts of CRBSIs that we would have a multidisciplinary approach. As a pharmacist, I'm not necessarily involved when people are ordering and utilizing something like these chlorhexidine impregnated caps. And it's really important, I think, as a clinician, if you're trying to attempt a policy on antimicrobial lock therapy, you got to pick up the phone and you got to call your teams. You got to call your nurses. You got to call the medical director of the units and stuff like that, which is part of why I think a lot of us, we know we probably should update and simplify our approaches to antimicrobial lock therapy and other associated preventive and treatment measures of CRBSIs. But it's really hard. It's complicated. Like, there's a lot of key players, even more so than what you would expect in a typical QI project, in my experience, for this particular issue. So I really appreciate the approach that you've taken. And I really appreciate you, Joel, for going in and asking your colleagues and doing this. Is exactly the kind of information we were hoping to get from your perspective as a nephrologist. I haven't come across any data that would compare antimicrobial lock therapy and its effect on prevention or treatment of CRBSIs when in combination with some of these devices. I don't know, Joel, have you come across any data?
No, and I'd be concerned, you know, just compatibility issues, right? Yep. Is this going to cause different antibiotics to precipitate out? Like, I think these things need to be addressed.
Yeah, definitely an area for research. So I think that's another call for our audience. We've got a lot of really all-star listeners that are always looking for important QI projects and important research. So I think that's kind of the next frontier, too, in looking at prevention and treatment of CRBSIs. Thank you so much for doing that extra digging for us. I find that really empowering and hopeful to know that a lot of other people are looking at this.
A lot of creativity coming to this problem.
And now back to our conversation with Lou, Nasia, and Joel.
Yeah. So I guess all four of us at this point are supporters of value-based care for lots of reasons, but not least of which is it makes implementation of antimicrobial lock therapy easier. Switching real quick, just to make sure that we're complete here, There are other settings such as home infusion, long-term care facilities, et cetera, that do have some patients that, you know, we want to implement lock therapy in that scenario. Does anyone have any suggestions or experience with getting patients transitioned and successfully doing lock therapy in those settings?
We have a few select partners that we work closely with that handle a lot of our home-based CRBSI management in patients. And so partnering with them early to make sure they're included in the guideline and that they can actually do it at that transition of care has been helpful to us. We haven't found very many challenges in that scenario where the partnership has been established and they have a really good sense of what to do. But in other settings where you don't have that, you know, the patient is from out of state and they're going with a different care agency, I think it becomes a lot more challenging.
So the key there is collaborate. You want to talk to both your subacute facilities and then also your OPAP partners as well. I like that. That makes a lot of sense. And we as stewards are really good at doing that. So I foresee that being promising moving forward. Thank you guys so much for your perspectives. Hopefully this provides folks with actionable information regarding antimicrobial lock therapy and empowers at least a couple of our listeners. I know this has probably been on your to-do list for a while, but hear it from the four of us, it can be done. Keep it simple. Don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. So now for our favorite segment of the pod, I Feel Nerdy. I Feel Nerdy is a safe space to nerd out over your favorite ID topics, quirks, and fun facts. For today's I Feel Nerdy, I want to know from our panelists, what is your favorite tip to prevent microbial contamination and why? This can be an ingredient, a technique, a quirk of how bugs get around in our environment. It's open to interpretation and stories are welcome. So Nasia, I'm going to go to you first.
Well, I really like the idea of scrubbing the hub. You need to do that when you're putting the lock in, and you'll need to do that when you're aspirating the lock out. So the more we can remember to do that reliably, the better off you will all be.
I love it. Yep. Spoken as a true ID physician. You're like, prevent the infection to begin with. I love it. All right, Lou.
It's the catheter version of wash your hands.
It's the catheter version of wash your hands. You know what? I'm going to use that. I like that a lot.
I like that a lot too.
Lou, go for it.
I guess my favorite tip is that folks should culture the tip when removing a catheter that they suspect is infected. That still sometimes fails to be done. So I think, you know, little pun there. And honestly, I defer a lot of the prevention of antimicrobial contamination to Nasia and Joel, but I would want to put in a plug for pharmacists here because we do end up doing a lot of the heavy lifting with locks. So don't let your pharmacist go unnoticed.
Yeah, definitely have them on speed dial. We are happy to help. I would prefer that you guys reach out to us. So again, as a pharmacist too, I can definitely agree with that. Joel, what you got?
So I just want to go back that the best way to avoid catheter-based bloodstream inspections is to get out of the catheter. And that for our dialysis patients, we have alternative dialysis accesses that are beneficial not only in terms of reduced infection rate, but more effective dialysis, less inflammation, less bioincompatibility. And when they do get infections, they're less likely to get endocarditis, right? They don't have a piece of plastic sitting in their atrium. So there's lots of reasons to try to encourage your patients to get rid of their dialysis catheter. And honestly, I believe that the more people that are telling these patients from different venues that it's not just the doctors, it's not just the dialysis nurses, but if the pharmacist stops in or the nurse looks in and says this, these are all ways to push our patients to do that for themselves.
I love that. It's truly a interprofessional and collaborative effort as represented by you wonderful panelists for today's episode. I'm definitely down to send patients your way, Joel, for alternative, more permanent access that's safer and more efficacious. Nasia, thank you so much for all the care that you give to our patients. And Lou, can't wait to send other people screenshots of your order sets. Bravo, my friend. With that, thank you all for joining me today. And thank you, our loyal audience, for listening to Breakpoints, the Society of Infectious Diseases Pharmacist Podcast. I have been your host, Julianne Justo, and our featured speakers have been Drs. Lou Alexic, Nasia Sufdar, and Joel Toff. Funding for this episode was provided by a grant from CoreMedics, and we're incredibly grateful for their support. Breakpoints was created by me, Julianne Justo, Aaron McCreary, and Jason Pogue. This episode was produced by Jeanette Bouchard and Megan Klatt. It was edited by Besma Hassani and peer-reviewed by Emily Kirkpatrick and Ashley Selby. Our production team includes Aileen Ahiskali, Anna Zhu, Raneem Pelota, and Justin Ma. The executive producer of Breakpoints is Aaron McCreary. Our theme song was recorded by SIDP member Steve Smoke. You can subscribe to Breakpoints on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening and helping SIDP achieve our vision of safe and effective antimicrobials for now and the future.